ESPN 97.5 and 92.5 proudly present The Killer Bees.
Definitely a fan of The Killer Bees.
Don't sweat the technique.
Now from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, bringing you the fastest 3 hours in Houston sports radio, here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
What up, H-Town? Hey, how we doing?
He's Blank, I'm Branham, it's Brian behind the glass, and it's a Wednesday edition of the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5. Busy show. Texan schedule is going to come out. It's already pretty much all out. We'll talk about that. Granato gave a schedule leak earlier today.
I heard that.
It was the worst schedule leak ever.
I'm
not sure he's going to get one game right. Well, the Jets one I think is technically right, although the date's wrong. He has the right week, but I think he said it was going to be Thursday Night Football, and it's like a noon start. Or
Lance,
it was Packers.
Lance was like starting to defend it, too, going, you know, I work for
online?
The NFL Network. No,
I'm on air.
During the show. I work for the NFL Network. And Dell was like, no, not really, because your schedule right now that you're claiming to be accurate is literally the Bears that's been out is playing someone in week six. And Lance's like,
I made the mistake of posting it on Twitter, and like I'm getting crushed for being the messenger of the schedule leak. So it's the worst schedule leak of all time. But we are getting some like real leaks that we'll get to. We'll talk about that, what it means for the Texans, blah, 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 blah. But we're going to start with the Astros, and we're not going to talk about Ronel Blanco yet. We're going to talk about Ronel Blanco in about 10, 12 minutes. We're going to talk about everything that went on. We're going to talk about how it relates to the rest of Major League Baseball and other pitchers that it's happened to in the past. But first, let's focus on the good that came from that game yesterday. Astros winning it 2-1. And look, you did lose your starting pitcher after the third inning, so that is difficult to try to overcome, losing your starter in the third inning. Good news, he didn't give up a run. And then your bullpen was fantastic after that. Taylor Scott, 2 shutout innings. Rafael Montero, 3. He struck out the side.
Yep.
Struck out the side. Brian Abreu, shutout inning. Ryan Pressly, a little bit stressly. And then Josh Hader, yet again, Hader the gamer, goes 2 shutout innings. He puts up the goose egg in the top of the 10th, which allows for the heroics and Victor Caratini getting the walk off for the Astros. Astros win, yay. They've won 5 of 6. That was a huge win for the Astros, and everything that happened in that game too, maybe it's one that continues this springboard for the Houston Astros.
Look, 5 out of 6 by itself is something that we wanted to see, but kind of to your point, my unsung hero last night was Hader. I mean, the fact that Hader, for the third time, comes up with multiple innings. I'm looking down there, and you're hearing TK and Blummer talk about it, too, and I'm going, oh, my God, if we get to Dubin, it's over. I was extremely impressed with Oakland's bullpen, first and foremost. But secondly, we've seen this play out before, where they get to the 10th inning, they get to the bottom of the barrel of their bullpen, and then they cough another game up. And you're like, this is one you didn't want to lose because of everything you went through and everything you've got going momentum-wise, as you mentioned, going forward. And yet, Hader steps up big. He does his job. I mean, second and third, one out, gets out of that. No runs scored. You get it done in the bottom half of the inning, and all's well that ends well. Fantastic. Yeah, they're going to be challenged going forward because of the fact that you had to go that deep into the bullpen. But it had been a lot more difficult to take if you knew that and you lost that game last night.
If you're throwing the big three in a game, if you're throwing Brian Abreu, you're throwing Ryan Pressly, if you're throwing Josh Hader, that's a game that you need to win. And quite frankly, like, there's been a lot that's went wrong with the Astros so far this year, 17-25, getting closer to 500, 42 games into the season. A lot has gone wrong. But the fact that you've blown 8 saves whenever you have this big three, I think is the biggest reason that you're in this spot. So when those guys throw, you're expected to win those games. Mm-hmm. You should win 90% of the games, maybe more, if those guys are throwing. Now, you're not always going to have the lead. Sometimes they're going to be throwing in a tie game. You know, you got to score, you got to scratch. But when those guys are throwing, when the big three's throwing, you have to win those games. Those are games that you must win. And you're wasting games. If they all 3 pitch and you lose that game, well, now you're behind the 8-ball tomorrow,
double whammy,
the next day. So you lose the game, and then you're behind the 8-ball the next day because you threw all your leverage guys, and those leverage guys aren't available.
Yeah.
When those guys throw, it is imperative to win the baseball game.
No question. And because of the fact that in the past, whether it's the fact that Pressly normally, you know, you wanted to handle him with kid gloves, if he got, you know, throwing 2 days in a row or 3 out of 4 and all those things, Abreu's about the only guy that they don't do those kind of things with. Hader, we know in the past that the rumors about him were that he would never go more than an inning. Now he's done it 3 times for you, and that's a huge bonus. But we know how important the back three was supposed to be all season long. But we also know that they have been less than that to get to this point in the season or close to it. So now, when the team is kind of finding its stride, the last thing you can ill afford to do is burn those guys, take an L, and then know that two or three of them are probably not going to be available for, a stretch where you don't have a game off for a while. So big time win for them. I felt very uneasy the whole time looking, as the pitcher, mm-hmm. as they kept getting by another pitcher going, oh man, this goes to extras. I just had that feeling we've seen this play out, but thankfully they got the win.
The Hader thought he'd give up a home run.
Oh, did you hear him? Yeah. The F-bomb was very audible the minute that the bat met the baseball.
I'm surprised TK didn't apologize to all the children immediately because he thought that ball was gone. But then he was able to work out of the jam, got out of it, and then the Astros win it in the bottom of the 10th. I can't say enough good things about Hader. Look, I think it's fair to criticize Josh Hader for not taking the ball in a pennant, in the stretch drive in a pennant race. I think it's fair. Well, he's only going to give you three outs. I think it is fair to talk about a pitcher and be like, hey, I don't love a guy like that. What I like about Hader, though, is now that I got paid, I'm at your service. I'm at your will. And Hader's proven that narrative. Look, I don't really think it's a narrative. I think it was true. I think it was a fact. But now that he's gotten paid, he got his carrot, so to speak, and now he's willing to give you whatever he has, and I admire that.
Well, I think that, it's kind of similar to what we talked about yesterday when we were talking about Bregman. Sometimes, as difficult as it is for the fan base and sometimes even the team to accept, guys are going to make business decisions based on their own individual situation. Bregman put on the 20-some pounds. He started, changing his swing, trying to get more lift, doing a bunch of stuff because it's a contract year, because he's trying to get paid. Hader was the same thing. At least there was more transparency in the fact that he was coming out and just basically saying, hey, you know what? It was basically until I got paid because I didn't want to do something that damaged my arm, put me in an arbitration year, and then put me behind the eight ball trying to make money because I would be hurt and medically teams wouldn't want to touch me. The fact that he got his money and now is willing to do whatever, as you mentioned, and especially for this team now because of how we've been worried about the bullpen, it's huge. And the fact that he seems like he not only talked about it when he signed about wanting to fit into this culture and how it meant something to him to play here, but it seems like he wants to be that kind of teammate, and they need that. That's fantastic.
Yeah, it's good to see that. Really good to see that. Mason Miller's a behemoth,
by the way.
He's 25?
Filthy,
25 years old.
Filthy. That guy is really good.
So I've seen tweets about him before this series. I didn't know his story. I hadn't heard of him last year, actually. He actually pitched 33 innings last year, appeared in 10 games, actually started 6 games. Looks like an opener, though, because he only threw 33 innings. So this was the first year I'd ever heard of Mason Miller. So yesterday after the game, I went and did a deep dive on Mason Miller. What's his story? What's his background? Where did he come from? Where was he drafted, et cetera, et cetera? Right. This guy was homeschooled. Mason Miller was this homeschooled freak that all of a sudden throws gas. He went to some random prep school. He went went to college, but it was a college I don't remember. And then he transferred to Gardner-Webb for his fifth and final year. He was at some no-name college, almost D2 baseball. And then for his fifth and final year, he transferred to Gardner-Webb, which I think they have a pretty decent baseball program, but it's Gardner-Webb. It's not like this Power 7, Power 5, Power 6 school. It's Gardner-Webb. But he threw gas at Gardner-Webb. He was drafted in the third round and has been on the skyrocket to the big leagues. That guy might be the best reliever in baseball. And, back of the baseball card, he hasn't done it long enough. Okay, if you had to get one out right now, everybody's healthy. Everybody's healthy. It's the best hitter in all of baseball. If you had to get one out, I'm not sure my answer isn't Mason Miller.
But think about this, Jeremy. What did we just get to talk about with Hader? A guy that until he got paid wasn't willing to go two innings? That dude did two innings easy for you last night.
Yeah, well, I mean, Hader did that early in his career, too, though. He stopped doing it whenever he became, eligible for arbitration.
But I'm saying in terms of value and what he means to a team, one, he's got filthy, filthy stuff.
He's so
touching
good.
103, not just once every blue moon. He's doing it pretty consistently. He struck out, 6 out of 7 guys or 5 out of 6 guys he faced last night?
He should have struck out Singleton. That was a bad call.
Yeah, two straight innings that he is locked down for you. His slider is not bad. He could locate it. And my goodness, the more I saw him, I was thinking this guy might be the best kept secret in baseball right now because he's impressive.
Yeah, I was. I have a little bit of a man crush on Mason Miller, and I'm not scared to admit it. That guy is filthy. What'd you think of Presley's inning?
I mean, the bloop double's unfortunate from Toro, but it's kind of like with the baseball gods. It just seems like when it ain't going good for you, you're gonna find a way to keep that kind of negative thing going for a little bit until you can find a way to sometime get a slump buster to bust out of it. Unfortunate, disturbing, aggravating, just kind of one of those things. I mean, it wasn't like he gave up a laser, but the double set the table, and then he got, you know, he couldn't keep him from scoring, so it was unfortunate.
Yeah, I'm ready to demote him. I put Brian Abreu in the eighth, although you still have to, you know, get scoreless innings, et cetera, et cetera. Wrist says that I thought Myers crushed it in the 10th. Oh, that was a fake Tony Stark. I thought Myers crushed it in the 10th, but it was only a sack fly. It really wasn't even a sack fly, which I hate that rule. He should get credit for his sacrifice there, but he doesn't. And then Wrist says that Myers bunting scared me. I thought he had a great plate appearance there, Myers. Great plate appearance.
I think the bigger thing for Riz is the fact that when you look at it, there's a majority of Major League Baseball these days that can't play to lay down a bunt, but at least he was able to differentiate pitches that were in the zone out of the zone and force the count to get to 3-2 eventually. And then he caught it off the end of the bat. Otherwise, that ball easily could have been off the wall or further and better. So it was a good at bat.
TK thought it was gone.
I think he did too.
TK thought it was good.
The replay, you saw that it was a great like slow-mo to see exactly where it hit, and it hit basically way on the end of the bat. If he gets that anywhere closer to the barrel, I don't think there's any doubt that that ball's probably gone.
Yeah, good at bat. Good at bat. I hate that it didn't give credit for a sacrifice, though. It's stupid. 9953, second-time hater, was what we thought he would be in a non-save two-inning scenario. Maybe he'd be more comfortable as the high-leverage 7 or 8 guy, move-off closer. I don't think Hader's the problem with this bullpen. Hader, don't mess with Hader. Hader's just fine.
It's the guy before him.
Yeah, and look, some of the peripheral numbers I know like show that Presley's been better than he is. Good. Let's hope that that's what happens from May 15th forward. 5046, could this be the greatest comeback in sports history if the Astros make the playoffs this year?
No, I don't think we're going to go that far, but let's also pump the brakes because they got to stay hot and keep doing what they're doing. But it's a nice start to what we needed to see.
Yeah, I mean, the Astros are off to a better start than the Tombstone Astros were in 2005. Now, you can go to the Boston Braves record or whatever. Like, I don't think it's the greatest comeback in sports history if the Astros make the playoffs.
I was like, but if you asked me what is?
Probably Buffalo against the Oilers.
You're probably right.
Probably Buffalo against the Oilers.
Yeah, in any sport. I'm saying from a baseball perspective, I can't think of, I mean, yeah, the Astros didn't win it, but that was a hell of a comeback to Tombstone year. The fact that the Phillies came back from way down last year, or was it last 2 years ago, mm-hmm. and got to the World Series, that was impressive.
There was some, like, Yankee Red Sox stuff, like, back in the, I don't even remember the
years. I mean, would it have to be the Red Sox
Boston
coming?
Massacre
from down 03?
Yeah, they're coming down, '03.
But just
yeah.
from a season perspective, like, digging yourself a massive hole and being able to come out of it. And, you know, and ride the wave.
There was that, the year where it was the Yankees-Red Sox, I don't know what year, I have no idea, but it was called the Boston Massacre, and the Yankees came back from some, like amazingly, like 6 or 7 games back with, like, 2 to 3 weeks to play. And I think that was the Bucky Dent year, because I think it went to game 163, and then Bucky Dent is the one who, like, put the cherry on top of the Boston Massacre. I'd have to go figure out the details on that.
That was a day game.
Was
it? Back in the day.
Well, did Fenway have lights?
Yeah.
Remember, Wrigley Field didn't have lights until the 80s.
Right. Wrigley was the last one. But, yeah, that was when baseball couldn't get a primetime national TV deal.
All right. Let's talk about the Renell Blanco situation. Got ejected from yesterday's game because of sticky stuff on his glove. 713-780-ESPN. Busy show. A schedule release. Renell Blanco, sticky stuff. Twitch.tv/ESPN975. That's where to find us. Or ESPN Houston on YouTube. Blankers is at Pac-Man Joel on Twitter. Brian's at Sacked by BMAC. I'm at Jeremy Branham. It's the Bees on ESPN97.5 and ESPN92.5.
Guys, before we go to the break, a word from a good friend, Doc Linville, who could be a good friend of yours, too, because he can get your hair back. If you're losing your hair, you've got thinning, balding, you don't think there's anything you can do about it, I'm here to tell you there is a solution using your own hair that is a game changer. It is called the Neograft procedure. He also does something called PRP, which you've heard with athletes use it for their knees and their joints with the platelet-rich therapy that kind of rejuvenates what's going on with your muscles. It can also do the same thing with your hair. There's two different options. Both are very effective. Both get results, and both are offered by Doc Linville here in Houston, Texas. What you need to do is go to 975hair.com right now, because if you listen to us and you go to that website, you can get a free consultation with Doc and his staff to find out how they can help you get your hair back, too. I say, too, because I did the procedure. It was phenomenal. It was painless. It was just one of the easiest things I've ever been through, and I saw the hair follicles immediately. I saw the actual full results in about 6 to 9 months, and I couldn't be happier with what he was able to do for me. He can do the same thing for you, too. You don't have to pay a single thing out of pocket or commit to anything because you listen to us and you want to talk to him. By the way, the consultation normally costs $150. For you, it's free. 975hair.com, set up the consultation, go in, have them explain it to you, ask questions, get answers, see if you're the next in line to get the great procedure. I said I did it. I will speak for him as long as he wants me to because I believe in it. And I'm telling you, it's the real deal. Check him out today. Tell him I sent you by. It's 975hair.com.
ESPN 97.5. You're listening to The Killer Bees with Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham
on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5.
Broadcasting live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios.
Ronel Blanco was ejected for sticky stuff yesterday. Coming back out to start the fourth inning, his glove was checked. The umpires found that it was sticky. They ejected him from the game, sent his glove to the commissioner's office. Of course, if you're caught using the sticky stuff, whatever it is, you get ejected and a 10-game suspension is coming up. Ronel Blanco mentioned afterwards, plan is to appeal it based on what they hear. Watching that kind of transpire was weird, so bizarre, because
really
you come out of the, and it's one thing to like be there because you start to see the buildup. Oh, you see the umpires out there waiting for them. You see them come together. But the way that, you know, the shin, and they have no choice during commercial break, they come out, they like do like this ad, and then it's like the umpires are huddled around and there's Ronel Blanco in the background. Like, what in the world just happened?
The guys were still doing all the infield work, yeah. And he was the only guy on the field. And then thankfully later on, they doubled back and Blummer was able to say, because I was unaware of the fact that it's like random drug testing. They can look at the mitt and your hand whenever they want.
Yeah.
I always thought it was because you always see it going to commercial break, the pitcher leaving the mound and on his way to the dugout. And one of the first base dump or the home plate dump runs out there, does the hand check real quick, blah, 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 done. I was not aware of the fact that they randomly do it before an inning starts too. Which kind of was my first thing. Like, that's why it was so confusing at first, because I'm like, what's he doing? And is he allowed to do that? Is that normal? Or is that something he's doing as a special trip because he saw something when he went back to the... And then it was just all of his hand gestures to the press box and all the things he was doing. I thought, was he trying to land a plane, or what's he doing with Blanco? And then all hell broke loose.
That was the weird thing to me. It's like, I didn't know that you could... I knew that you could with relievers. Like, when relievers come in games, they usually check them first. I didn't realize with a starter that you could do it whenever you wanted. I went in and was Googling that, but I was unaware of that as well. Now, some of what was said after the game, like the Astros, I mean, basically admitted this. Joe Espada said in his postgame, yeah, you know, I looked at the glove and it looked to me like there was rosin and sweat combined. Ronel Blanco talking through an interpreter after the game. Yeah, I think it was rosin that mixed with sweat. And it's against the rules. Like, it's against the rules to have that on your non-throwing hand or your glove. So, I mean, the Astros basically admitted guilt here. So I really had no problem with the ejection. I have no problem with what's going to come with a suspension. Does it put the Astros in a tough spot? Yes, it does. It really makes it very difficult for Espada to handle the pitching staff in the midst of 29 of 30, with still 21 of 22 left in that 29 of 30, depending on when he, you know, serves the suspension or drops the appeal of a suspension, whatever happens. I don't have a problem with the ejection. Like, that is the rule. Is it a bad rule? You know, that's up for debate. That's something you can argue, but it is the rule. Cannot have sticky stuff, cannot have the rosin combined with the sweat on the non-throwing hand for a pitcher. Now, what I don't like about this is that it does not seem consistent with the rest of Major League Baseball. Domingo Germán for the Yankees last year, actually, he got busted twice. They kicked him out of the second game. The first game, he was just told, hey, go wash your hands, switch your gloves. I think it was Clay Holmes of the Yankees that also had that happen. So, what I don't like is the consistency of how this rule is enforced. If that is against the rules, okay, I have to adhere to the rules. Throw me out of a game, suspend me. That is the rules of baseball. I don't like the gray area of how one umpiring crew is going to eject the guy, and then you have two or three other umpire crews that say, you know what, just go wash your hands and you can keep throwing.
So Germán did it. Then I did a little bit of a deep dive last night and this morning, and a year ago to the day, yesterday, Schmidt of the Yankees was caught. He had a black glove on his non-pitching hand. He had black dye remnants from the glove, which first tipped off the umpires. When they looked, it was sticky and it was moist. They did the same thing. They told him he had to go in and wash his hands. It was against Cincinnati, and then he was able to continue. 2 days ago, Yamamoto of the Dodgers came out after his first or second inning, and the umpire said that there was a white, powdery, sticky substance on his glove.
I don't think Yamamoto was sticky stuff. I think it was because he had too much white on the glove. I don't think it was stickiness.
I saw three different articles, and two of the writers said that they identified a white, powdery substance on the glove that was somewhat sticky, so they asked him to change the glove. So to your point, what are we doing? I mean, if it's anything on the arm or the glove, are we just telling him, wash your hands and change the glove? Or if it's on the glove and the arm, like, you know, they indicated after the game that he said he was putting stuff on his non-pitching arm, the rosin, then he's ejected. Like, you can't have it one way one time and a different way the next. It has to be consistent, or what are we doing?
Yeah, that's the biggest issue I have. Because, I mean, Espada said what he said, yes. Yeah, there was I think, rosin combined with sweat on the glove. Okay, well, that's an ejection, and that's a suspension based on how the rule is written. But you got to do it with the other guys that also happens here. And then it begs the question, well, you know, what's the difference? And you look at some of what was said by the umpires after the game. Laz Diaz, Blanco said it was just rosin, and we told him this is not rosin. So that is the line of demarcation. Is like, if you think that it's rosin and sweat, like, they'll allow you to go wash your hands and get a new glove, all of that. But if they feel like it's more than rosin, well, now they're going to throw you out of the game, and they're going to have Major League Baseball is going to, you know, do their background test with all the science, and then they're probably still going to suspend you because Max Scherzer had the rosin and sweat, yep, and they suspended him. So the fact that it's so gray is what I don't like. Now you have different crews that are trying to judge what is sticky, how much is too sticky. Is this enough stickiness to throw him out of a game? Is this not enough stickiness to keep him in the game? So I think there should be the universal rule. If you find sticky stuff on the glove, whatever it is, whether you think it's rosin or whether you don't think it's rosin, it should be an ejection. It should be an ejection and a suspension.
Yeah, it has to be consistent. I mean, because, you know, you think about it in the past, there are pitchers that change gloves. Fromber was one of those guys. They change gloves every inning sometimes, or they keep changing things. But you have to have consistency. And if you're not going to, I don't know if you saw the David Cone video like a year ago or so. The other thing that bothers me is, you know, you're not chemists. You're not the experts that go in and say, well, that's rosin or that's not, unless you know the different combinations of sweat, water, and rosin that can actually, Cone did the video where you could actually put it on his fingertips, touch it to a baseball, and hold the baseball up off the table to realize that's pretty damn sticky. If you're able to do that and take gravity out of the equation, that means it's got some hold to it. It's got some stick. The first base umpire said it was the stickiest thing he's ever felt on a glove.
Yeah, he said it was the stickiest stuff I've felt on a glove since we've been doing this for a few years now. Now, how much of that is an umpire defending his actions? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, that's tough for me to take that seriously. But at the same time, like, hey, you felt sticky stuff, a guy should be ejected. I don't have a problem with that. I don't have a problem that Blanco was ejected. And McTaggart just tweeted that Major League Baseball has issued a suspension to Ronel Blanco 10 games. Undisclosed fine. Now, he can't appeal that. And, you know, should he? We'll talk about it in a moment.
Right.
713-780-ESPN. A couple of the other things that were said off of this. Asked if the umpires could determine what the substance was. Laz Diaz says, we don't determine that. We just felt it was sticky. Sticky enough that our fingers got stuck. So if the line of demarcation is you feel like it's great, like, listen to what Laz Diaz said on two different answers. He said it, he, Blanco, said it was just rosin. And then we told him that it's not rosin. Later, Diaz asked if the umpires could determine what the substance was. Diaz said, we don't determine that. We just felt it was sticky. Sticky enough that our fingers got stuck. That's talking out of both sides,
yep,
of your mouth.
Sure is.
You said that it was more than rosin, and now you're saying that you can't determine what the substance was. You said it was greater than rosin. So again, kind of the vague, gray inconsistencies of this. If you want to be strict with this rule, I have no problem being strict with this rule. It's got to be universal. It's got to be consistent. Joe Espada said from his vantage point that he saw rosin mixed with sweat on Ronel Blanco's glove. Of course, that's illegal. Blanco said through an interpreter, what I told him, the umpires, is that if that he found something sticky in my glove, he should also check my hand because it should also be on my hand, Blanco said. He didn't want to check my hand. I don't think that matters, quite frankly, with all due respect to Ronel Blanco. I don't know why that is actually pertinent.
But then one of the articles I was reading in the Schmidt deal with the Yankees last year was that was part of the reason why he was allowed to wash his hands and wipe the glove down and be able to come back in the game, because the umpires then continued on by checking his hands when they realized there was no sticky stuff. That's when they allowed it to continue. So if he doesn't have sticky stuff on his hands, again, to your point about consistency,
yeah,
you're either going to have a checklist of checkpoints and this is what's done when you find sticky stuff and this is the ramification, or you're not, because doing this just by on a whim, what you feel, gut feeling, is it rosin, is it not, and what I believe, you know, was affecting or not affecting his pitching, You can't do that. It's not just by your discretion. It has to be the rules by the letter of the law, because this is a very, very, obviously a big issue in baseball, and it has been for several years.
Yeah, the consistency of it is flat out ridiculous. The first thing that I asked myself was, like, is Blanco getting an advantage here? Has he been doing this all year? Because he's been really, really good. So I think those are questions you have to ask. I saw some other people, I'm not smart enough to do these studies, where they measured RPMs, Ronel Blanco this year versus last year, and then this year versus his start yesterday, and they're actually really consistent. Yep. So I don't think Ronel Blanco was gaining a competitive advantage. Again, broke the rules. Yes, he should have been ejected. I think that he should be suspended, or just everybody else should be as well. But I don't think he was actually gaining a competitive advantage. I do believe him that he was unaware of the rule. And, like, it's the other weird part is you can use it on your arm. You can use it on your non-throwing arm, right? You can use it on your throwing hand. You can use it on your non-throwing arm. It just can't be on the hand, and it can't be on the glove of the non-throwing hand, which is, I mean, confusing.
That's the weird thing, too. It can be on your forearm. Yeah. But it can't be on your hand or the glove.
Right, exactly. And two things about it. Like, Ronel Blanco was sweating like a pig. Like, go watch that first inning. I put a tweet out about it. Like, he was – and I noticed it in the first inning. It just, you know, obviously you don't think that he's going to get ejected later. But he was sweating profusely. And then J.P. Sears changed jerseys because he sweat through his uniform, the pitcher that was pitching opposite of Ronel Blanco. And then the other thing, I went back and I watched the third inning today because it's like, okay, well, I understand why the rule's in place, because if you get rosin and sweat, you get into the glove, you're trying to get, you know, grip on the baseball. Maybe you're rubbing up the baseball over and over. You're kind of going to the glove and doing that stuff. I went back and watched the third inning. I never saw Ronel Blanco take his glove off so he can't rub down the baseball, and I never even saw him go at his glove. So I don't, again, suspension, understand, ejection, fine. I do not think that Ronel Blanco is gaining a competitive advantage, which is good news in terms of his 2024 being for real and not this Mike Scott scuffing the baseball type of rumor.
Think about it, because they were calling out Fromber a year ago. Fromber was rubbing down baseballs. Fromber sweats profusely. I forget who they were playing in the dugout was calling for him to be examined over and over again. It was really ticking off Dusty because they kept going to it because it might have been even a playoff game.
I don't remember, but I remember the situation, but I don't remember who
and he kept
and
going like from the wrist to the ball to his temple and then rubbing everything down. I looked at some of the thing. You're more our numbers guy and analytics guy and all that spin rate stuff too. You find that a lot easier than I do, but I saw some of it. Looking for the same thing, like, because if you remember, I think it was either Herman or it was Severino, but one of the two Yankees got dinged for it, also threw a no-hitter that year. So I was like, okay, are they going to try to say that Blanco's no-hitter wasn't legit and his start this year wasn't legit? And the more you look at the numbers, the more, to your point, they were pretty consistent throughout, even into last night's game, that it didn't seem that there was a competitive advantage. It didn't seem that there was a big difference. So then, you know, I think hopefully it's a lot easier to say he wasn't full-blown cheating, because the one thing that was very, very telling to me was Dallas Braden, who does color analyst and a former pitcher in Major League Baseball, who threw a no-hitter for doing the A's. You're playing against the A's. You could easily just say, oh, they're cheating and go on it from the homer perspective of being the A's telecast. Instead, he was the guy that defended him, saying, hey, man, when you get the sweat that rolls down your arm and with the rosin and it can get inside your mitt and it can chunk up and get sticky, that's what he thought it was. As an ex-pitcher, that was a little bit more relieving to me to say he wasn't actually trying to get a competitive advantage.
Yeah, I don't think that he realized what was happening. I don't think he realized that that was a rule. And he even talked about it post-game. He said that, you know, he's seen other pitchers, which, again, you can use it on the arm.
That's the
you can use it
thing.
To drive. And they also put it on the stinking mound. Like, this goes back to the sign-stealing stuff. It's like, okay, this is going to be against the rules, but we're going to give you all this technology. Just don't do this one thing that we don't want you to do. It's like the same thing with the rosin bag. We're going to give you the rosin bag. Just don't do that one thing that you can't
do. And you see guys pound their forearm when they're sweating with the rosin bag. So you can do it on your forearm, but don't put it on your hand. But God forbid if the sweat from the forearm that you put it on slides down into your hand or on your hand or in your mitt, then you face suspension and you face ejection. Like, what do we? And you can't put gauze on around your wrist or wear a wristband to keep it from going onto your hand.
Yeah.
Like, what are we doing?
Yeah, it's weird. 713-780-ESPN. Let's go out to the HRNP listener line. Bill and Katie, you're in the Hive with the Bees. What's up?
Hello, how you doing?
Good.
I just want to know, how much do y'all think this is personal? He's in an Astros uniform. You think there's any remorse or anything? Because when a Yankees pitcher does it, it's okay. But when we do it, you're out of there. That's all I got to say.
I've seen that be a prevalent opinion on Twitter, I don't think that they're looking to go get the Astros in this situation. I mean, this is something that's protocol through umpires in baseball. It's been that way, and it's done as a regiment every game for the last couple of years to where, I mean, if you feel it, you notice it, you have to say something about it. I think to our point, there has to be more consistency in how it's enforced when you do feel it or find it. It is a little, I get it, though, it's a little bit bothersome.
Yeah.
Especially when you talk about, well, the Yankees and the Dodgers got away with it, and the Astros didn't.
Yeah, I think that there's some protecting big markets, like when we talk about sign stealing and stuff. I don't really think that's the case here. I think this is more just inconsistency amongst crews, because it's very difficult. Like, okay, this umpire crew on the left, and then this umpire crew on the right, you guys have to tell me what's too sticky and what's not too sticky. It's like, okay, which wine is good? You know, like the umpiring crew on the left and the umpiring crew on the right might have two different tastes. They might have two different interpretations. Like, they might have two different opinions. That's why it's got to be consistent across the board. If it's sticky on the glove, you shouldn't be the gatekeeper on what's too sticky or not. If there's any stick at all, ejection, suspension, let's be consistent across the board. But I don't think that it was like a vendetta against the Astros. I don't believe that.
I think when you think about it, it's like different umpires have different strike zones. Different crews have different ways of calling, say, pass interference or roughing the quarterback in football or in basketball. You call it a tight game or you letting them play and letting them get physical. I mean, every crew is different and every umpire has his own interpretation, obviously, and opinion of how to call that specific rule. And it's going to vary from crew to crew. And unfortunately, you know, with this crew, and I say unfortunately because it didn't benefit the Astros. Yeah. But at the same time, this crew probably got it right by the rules.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with this crew, actually. Now, the last Diaz, well, we felt it was more sticky than rosin, but then we're not going to determine what is rosin and what is not. Like, okay, well, that's a contradiction. But yeah, I have no problem with ejection, and I have no problem with suspension. Let's just be consistent, guys. 713-780-ESPN. Espada made a couple of questionable decisions yesterday. They all worked, but let's talk about them. 713-780-ESPN. Killer Bees, ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5. You know what else works? HRMP. HRMP is fantastic. It works every time. And it's making your business better. It's taking a lot off of your plate so you can spend time on growing your business back up or doing other things you like to do. My colleague, O'Cougs, U of H class of 1990, he's been protecting the interests of businesses for nearly 25 years. He used to protect a Heisman Trophy winner. Now he's protecting your business. He is in the business. HRMP provides comprehensive human capital management services, including HR compliance, benefits administration, and payroll. HRMP will also work with you to customize a plan for whatever you need. Wherever you're weak, they're going to help you there. Wherever you're strong, they might not help you there. Wherever you need the help, that's where HRMP is going to help you. Nothing cookie cutter. They can help with everything. They can help with very little. They're going to create a plan, though, for what you and your business needs. Their customer service is fantastic. You're going to love their customer service. You'll never talk to a stranger on the other side of the line. Everybody you talk to will be familiar with you, and they'll be familiar with your company. I can speak to that customer service. We use it here, of course, at Gal. Very fortunate that we use it here at Gal. Let HRMP take on the demands of human resources and eliminate your HR burden so you can get back to growing your business. Give them a call at 281-880-6525 and let HRMP customize a plan for you. 281-880-6525 or check them out at HRP.net. That's HRP.net.
ESPN 97.5.
Up the middle, walk off for the second time this year. Victor Caratini wins it again for the Astros, 2-1.
I had a little, that's our friend, by the way, Todd. We're friends with that guy. Todd Gallis joins us each and every Friday. He'll be joining us again this Friday. Astros get the walk-off. Victor Caratini has the clutch gene. I question this call from Joe Espada. I'll admit, I'd rather be wrong than do the hindsight 2020 game anyways. You had a runner at third, less than two outs, and you have Mauricio Dubon, who's scheduled to hit, who is maybe the most elite contact hitter in all of baseball. Let's be very clear what I said. I said contact. He's really good at touching the baseball. I didn't want a pinch hit in that spot. I was questioning the decision. Now, it worked out. Hey, Espada, you made the call. Great call. I'm not going to criticize moves that you were wrong. But whenever you saw that the pinch hit was coming, what were your thoughts?
With Caratini, I felt okay with him from the left. I felt, you know, coming up, I felt like he was going to be a guy that it's a bat I trust. But I totally understand your point because I think Dubon is second in either all of baseball or the American League in what average with runners in scoring position.
Yeah, see, that's not even one I knew. Like, I know he was good at with runners in scoring position. I didn't know it was that high.
Yeah.
I didn't know it was second. To me, I want a guy who could put the ball on the bat with less than two outs and a runner
Fair.
At third.
Right. And, you know, and then he got down in the count early, right?
Yeah, he was two strikes.
Yeah,
oh,
I was
two.
Like, oh, my God, this may not work out well. But I wasn't thinking Dubon at that point. I was fine with the fact that he went to Caratini because I think Caratini's been pretty good so far this year. And he had the one game-winning bomb. But I think that I've liked his approach at the plate most times. I was good with it. I'm glad it worked out. But you make a good point about Dubon.
Here was a spot after the game when asked, why Caratini in that spot?
Yeah, you know, infield's going to be in. You know, the splits are favorable for Caratini. And, you know, he's going to put the barrel on the ball. And he did, you know, he did it again.
So, like he mentioned there, like
did anybody follow up on Dubon?
He feels like that's a guy that's going to, you know, and maybe Caratini has a better barrel rate than Dubon, but Dubon certainly has a better chance of touching it. In terms of the splits, Caratini has a 222 because there was a righty on the mound. Mm-hmm. He's 222 this year batting average against right-handed pitching. Mauricio Dubon's 281. And if you're like, well, Mauricio Dubon doesn't slug enough. Dubon's slug against righties is 406. Caratini's like 422. So it's like it's marginal. Maybe they're going career splits. Let me pull up the career splits. I have noticed that Joe Espada, he gives more value to career splits than he does.
On the back of his baseball card.
Beat me to it, Brian.
he gives more value to the career splits. Caratini, a lifetime against right-handed hitters, is a 238 hitter. He has 246 strikeouts and just over 1,000, just under 1,100 at bats. Mauricio Dubon lifetime is a 246 hitter against righties. Dubon's got the better average. He strikes out way less than Victor Caratini. Look, I'm happy that it worked, and I'm not going to critique. I know it sounds like I'm critiquing. I'm not going to critique moves that worked out. This one kind of baffles me. This one baffles
Do
me a little bit.
That with the possibility that they could have changed pitchers and he's a switch hitter, that he could have got it from either side of the plate?
Help. Well, no, because if they switch pitchers, now you have a lefty, and Dubon's way better against lefties.
But well, you're right. But I'm saying, so initially you make the initial change, right, to Caratini, and then if they decide to change pitchers, then he's a switch hitter. He can hit from either side of the plate.
Yeah, right. I see what you're saying. But it doesn't really apply here because if they switch pitchers to a lefty – that helps Mauricio Dubon. So if they're playing matchups, they're not going to make the pitching change to then give you the favorable at bat.
Right. No, but I'm saying because this is more like Pawpaw's belly last year. This is like Espada. He says he's going with numbers, but it seems more like he had a feeling.
Yeah.
But say you make the change and you go to Caratini, and then the A's decide to make a pitching change because you're going to.
Right. I understand what you're saying, but if you're making a pitching change, either you're bringing in another righty, so it doesn't matter that Caratini's a switch hitter, or you're bringing in a lefty, which favors Dubon.
Yeah, but Dubon, okay, I'm just saying, because Dubon's already out of the game if he comes in for him, and that's why you make the pitching change. And then you say, is Caratini better from the right side or left side?
Well, I mean, traditionally, he's better from the left side. So, if they were to make the change and bring in a lefty, now it actually hurts you. And if you wanted to tell me, like, Papa's gut, okay, like, cool. Like, it seems like Victor Caratini has the clutch gene. He hit the walk-off home run, second walk-off. Okay, I can live with that. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I can live with the feel. I can live with the vibes. I'm cool with a manager that manages based on vibes. I'm cool with that. It's why I was cool with Dusty forever, just really last year. But then to say, well, the numbers back up Caratini, no, they really don't. They really don't, Joe. So that kind of confused, but hey, it worked. So we're not going to criticize a move that worked. Another move that they made in the 10th inning, which I saw criticized by some, second and third, two outs, Brent Rooker's the Oakland A's best hitter. He's up in the box. They decide to pitch to him with first base open. Were you okay with that, or did you want the intentional walk there?
I would have walked the bases loaded. I thought that it's a smart baseball play, force at all the bases. And like you said, I mean, he's easily one of their hottest, if not their hottest hitter. And it's just smart baseball. I don't know if he got questioned about that after the game, but it definitely crossed my mind that in that situation, why wouldn't you? You set up a force at any base, you know, you've got options on getting outs, and instead you pitch to the best hitter on their team and he beat you.
So this is one that I actually back up a spot on this one. And here's why.
Why?
Because I think a lot of scenarios, you're right. But why I'm right here is I feel like my guy's better than their guy. And what is my guy's weakness, though? My guy's weakness is command. Like, he is prone to walking a guy. So if you intentionally walk Rooker, and now, okay, when that first base is not open, you're putting a lot of pressure on Hader to throw strikes. And if Hader walks a guy in that spot, go ahead, run. So I actually defend Espada with that move. The Dubon one, hey, I was scratching my head. I tweeted about it because I believed if you're going to critique a manager, you should do it before it actually, if we find out the result. I don't like the hindsight 2020 game. Hey, it worked for Espada. That's why you're managing, and I'm just a jabroni that's talking on a microphone. Speaking of jabronis, Will Doctor.
You influence people.
I'm kidding. I love Will. I am an influencer. Will Doctor, you might not realize this, but there is a golf major that begins tomorrow. The PGA Championship at Valhalla. Is that how it's pronounced?
Valhalla.
Rory McIlroy won there last time it was played at Valhalla. Will Doctor, who is the best golf handicapper that exists on this planet, he joins us live in studio to tell you what you need to be betting for golf's second major of 2024. It's Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN
92.5.
You're listening to ESPN 97.5. You found the Killer Bees, live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios. Here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
Joining us live in studio, Will Doctor. You see him on Twitter, DRMedia59, pregame now, the best handicapper in golf. Also doing some play-by-play on ESPN Plus during some of the PGA Tour events. I was listening to the podcast on the way in. First thing I'm going to ask you here, Will, I want you to crush me. I want you to look. I come from a golf family. I'm probably a golf casual. My dad's a golf pro. But here's my PGA Championship golf take that I want you to destroy. Just annihilate me. PGA Championship's not a real major. It's not a real major. I know it's a major, but it's not a real major. A distant fourth that it's hardly. It's closer to the golf's fifth major than it is golf's third major.
Yeah, Charlie Epps would annihilate me for saying this. But, yeah, you have 21 PGA professionals in the field. These are guys that spend their years growing the game, not playing the game professionally. So you could point out that you have 20 players in this field who would not qualify for a regular PGA Tour event. You could put the players over the PGA. But over the years, it's produced some great results, and there's no other course to verify.
Was the guy last year that caught fire for the first round or so? And
yeah,
was,
Michael Block.
There you go.
And he
Block
he,
party.
He finished top 15 and punched his ticket back into another PGA this year. But you've had your random winners over the years, and I think that's why there's that type of talk around the PGA Championship. Rich Beam, I mean, John Daly came out of nowhere way back in the day to win his first major at the PGA. Yeah. Keegan Bradley, Jason Duffner.
Even the Phil, though. Like, just on a Wednesday. Like, you know, in the Masters, you have a Wednesday before the Masters. Everybody's jacked up. British Open, even. There are a bunch of British people are going to be mad that I call it the British Open, not the Open Championship. And then the U.S. Open. Like, the buildup and the vibes on the Wednesday prior just feel totally different to me.
I would agree. And maybe it's because you have other sports playoffs going on right now, NBA, NHL. Maybe people aren't quite in the golf season yet, but I think the finish we're going to get this week, you're going to have your favorites kind of come to the top here.
The way they rescheduled to the events has played a part in that, too.
I like that it's second, though.
But the way that they used to space it out, because I remember the PGA was late in the season sometimes because they had it at Whistling Straits back home, and that was the year that was it Dustin Johnson grounded his club and what he thought?
Correct.
He thought it was not – it was one of the non-bunkers on the course, and instead he got dinged, got penalized, and ended up losing it. And there, you could feel it at that point because of the way the timing was of all the schedules of the majors. This kind of almost hurts the PGA even more.
I think so. I liked the PGA much better when it was the last major of the season. I liked going Masters, U.S. Open, British, and then PGA to
leading into the Tour Championship too, which was it had more impact on what was going to happen with the Tour Championship.
Especially at the end of the summer. I think with where sports is, that's a much better place for this golf tournament.
So talk to us about what to expect at Valhalla. Last time it was there, 2014, Rory won it. What do you think is the skill set required to win the PGA this weekend?
Yeah, this is a second shot golf course. Obviously, it's a big boys golf course, so you're not going to have your Brian Harmans or Colin Morikawas of the world come to the top, but after, you know, hitting the long ball off the tee, I really think it is a second shot approach golf course. Someone with a lead iron play, you look at the top three players in the world, which we'll talk about, Rory, Brooks, Scotty, you know, that fits in right with what they're doing well right now. And you look at Valhalla, there's a lot of people that are going to tell you that driving accuracy really matters. I've talked to a couple boots on the ground. Hallie Ledbetter with CBS Sports. The rough is not up that much. So you could get a bomb and gouge win, kind of a Bryson, Brooks Koepka, someone who's just going to launch it a mile off the tee. Accuracy not going to matter too much, but that second shot, 150 and in, those iron, that iron game is going to have to be on. Winning score when it comes to around the greens, I think the winning score is going to get to 14, 15 under this week. It's raining right now in Kentucky. The course is getting soft. It's not going to play a traditional firm PGA. Or
forecast said a couple days of rain, right?
Yeah. Friday and Saturday rain. I think once the course is soaked over the weekend, I think the scores get pretty low. So you're going to have a pretty solid putter in your pick as well.
Now, I know we're going to get into, you said, the top three and some of the guys, the favorites and things like that. But normally you're just talking about wedge play, drivers, consistency, how they hitting it. But you got relationship stuff rolling into two of the three right now that we were talking about. You got Rory filing for divorce after getting the win last week. You've got Scheffler, a new dad with all baby duties. Granted, he's probably got a nanny.
Yeah.
But he said he hasn't really been out playing golf for like a week or so to try and get back into it. But he was the hottest guy on tour coming in. How does that stuff affect these guys?
I heard Will. Sorry to interrupt. I was listening to the podcast today. Will had the line of the week. He said, Rory McIlroy, the tour doesn't want him and his wife doesn't want him.
It's pretty
good. I was like, geez, Will.
Yeah, well, that's what's going on. And to finish off your point, Brooks Koepka just became a dad 2 months ago.
It was
about a month before the Masters. Him and his wife welcomed baby crew to the mix. But well, let's start with Rory. Yeah, coming in off the divorce, he filed for divorce Monday. And everyone's kind of going, how is this going to affect him this week? He's got to be up in arms. There is no possible way that he won the Wells Fargo Championship by 4 shots on Sunday and didn't know that he was going to the Florida courtroom Monday to file for divorce.
Right.
This is a guy who we've seen go through pretty catastrophic breakups before. Take 2014 when he was dating Caroline Wozniacki.
Yeah.
He broke up with her and went and won the U.S. Open and Open Championship. I'm sorry, PGA Championship at Valhalla. And the Open Championship that year.
That's so coincidental. Serious relationships, we break up, and then I'm going to go play at Valhalla, maybe win the whole thing.
Wasn't the wife at the Wells Fargo when he coming off the green? I mean, he doubles 18 because the other could have won by 6. I thought that they had a shot or two of her.
Well, she was making sure she got half the check.
She was not there. And
it's probably true.
They got a prenup. Rory did a prenup.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that came out too in the papers. Yeah, Amanda Baliones of CBS Sports. Actually, if you go back and watch the post final round interview, Amanda only asked Rory about his mother and to comment on his mother.
So she knew.
Someone
he
tipped her off. Yeah.
She knew.
How do you got a 3-year-old Rory daughter? How do you not ask about his mother?
Rory or one of his people before the interview starts. Don't go that route.
Will Dr. DR Media 59 on Twitter. You can listen to him on ESPN 97.5. Also, pregame now where he handicaps each and every single one of these tour events. It's a great listen. Best handicapper in my mind that does it. And talk to us about some of the favorites that you like, some of the favorites that you're fading this week.
Yeah, I like Brooks Koepka a lot. I have him at 12-1 from December. You can get him at 16-1 now. I really like his mindset coming off the Masters. He finished 45th at the Masters. And you're not going to find a golfer who's harder on himself after kind of a disappointing finish like that. He said he had to apologize to his team, and he was disgusted by his performance. And then he goes to Live Singapore last week and wins in his prior start before this week. And we haven't seen anyone win the PGA on back-to-back occasions twice since Tiger. He did it in 99 and 2000 and then 06 and 07. Koepka has the chance to win his fourth PGA this week. He is my favorite to win this week. I think this course sets up perfectly for him, and we've seen that in PGA championships in the past.
When does a guy that's always knocking on the door, and Jeremy and I joke about this, but Xander Schauffele's playing good golf again.
Yeah.
He always seems to be hanging around, having a chance, and then he doesn't get it done. But it seems like his game right now is at a level where he should be competing this week.
Yeah, Xander stood on the 10th tee last week at Quail Hollow with a 4-shot lead.
Mm.
And Rory was standing on the 18th with a 7-shot lead. I don't want to call Xander a choker. That's not what he is. We don't see him come down the stretch in PGA Tour events and make doubles and triples. He let his short game get away from him, made 3 easy bogeys on the back 9. I just feel as far as Xander this week, man, when you have a tournament in your hands, through, you know, what, 64 holes,
mm-hmm.
and then lose and have to go play the next week. I know it's a major. I think I personally think coming in here off 2 weeks in a row, played Zurich, played Wells. I think I'm passing just because I think the gas tank could be a little empty after last week for Xander.
You mentioned long course. You mentioned the wet conditions. Yeah. Oh, how does that fare for Tiger Woods?
It's going to be a long week for Tiger. And I think when you kind of listen to his presser, you get that vibe from Tiger. You know, he for the first time this week, he admitted moving forward, he will only play the big events, the majors, maybe his event Riviera. I know that was kind of in the conversation, but if you look at what he said to start this year, he was kind of talking like he was going to play once a month. Not a good showing at Riviera, not a good showing at Augusta. I'm out on Tiger this week.
Well, they also said Augusta's known for the undulations as a tough walk.
Yeah.
But they said because of the fact that the course this week has a lot of elevated greens and from green to tee box, you're still doing a lot of the hills up and down that can affect him a lot. That's why he was talking about putting four rounds together. But part of that is the fact that the first two rounds, he gives it everything he can just to make the cut. And then his whole body starts just feeling everything.
7,600-yard walk around Valhalla this week. Moving forward on one leg, you guys know these U.S. Open and PGA setups, it's going to be a tough task for Tiger moving forward. I'm not going to rule him out. Could he win a green jacket at 52? I would not put it past him. U.S. Open venues and PGA venues, I'm out.
Will Doctor, you can follow him on Twitter, DrMedia59. Listen to the entire podcast pregame now for all of your plays. You mentioned you like Koepka, outright winner.
Yeah.
What are some of your other favorite bets this weekend that you're willing to give to us?
I like John Rahm over Ludvig Åberg. That's at minus 110. You can probably find that locally considering they're two favorites like we talked about before the show. I don't want to give out anything that you maybe couldn't find. but Rahm over Oberg's a great pick. You know, Rahm had a lot to say to the media this week. He's been finishing top eight on pretty much every LIV tournament. Unfortunately, or fortunately for us this week, he didn't play that well at the Masters where he was defending his championship. So a lot of the media have kind of fallen asleep on Rahm. He's still playing very well. He leads LIV in birdie average. And we saw Ludvig Åberg, who is a very promising rookie. He withdrew last week with a knee injury. He is on site this week. Him and his camp say that he's fine, but he's got a brace around the left knee. And my theory is I just don't think you would see a second-year professional withdraw from an event in the Wells Fargo last week where the winning check is $3.6 million. I don't see Åberg doing that unless there's something wrong. Let's fade him this week with John Rahm at minus 110, and you can probably find that locally.
Make sure you check out the podcast at Pregame Now. Will Doctor, the best handicapper in the golf business. Follow him on Twitter, DrMedia59. He's here on ESPN 97.5 on the weekends and doing some play-by-play for the PGA Tour events on ESPN 97.5. Check out the pod. You don't want to miss it. All the plays for the PGA Championship. Thanks so much.
One more thing. Scheffler's a green light. For all my Scheffler fans out there, plus 475, green light. I know he's coming off you know, becoming a new father. Meredith gave birth to baby Bennett. This guy came on property yesterday, and Todd Lewis says, you know, your wife just gave birth a week and a half ago. What are you doing out here? He looks the camera in the eye, and he goes, yeah, I told my baby boy goodbye, but I have a calling to be out here this week. And I'm looking at this press conference going, are you kidding me?
Yeah, he's ridiculous.
Green light on Scheffler this week. Joel and Jeremy, thank you for your time today.
You got it. Make sure you check out the podcast at Pregame Now. Really good. Make some money for the PGA Championship. All right, 713-780-ESPN. When we come back, game recognizing game. What did Tom Brady have to say about CJ Stroud? It's the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5.
ESPN 97.5.